We are joined today by John Baker. And John, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's story time with John. We want to hear how you started in architecture and what that career path has been like. You've already dropped several hints that you've been doing this for a while. So tell us what that means.
I've been doing it so long, I used to actually have hair. So there you go. I got interested in the profession when I was 13 years old. I had a great high school drafting teacher who, after a short period of time, allowed us to stop drawing cotter pins and machinery devices. And we actually designed a house and we got to draw architecture. And I just fell in love with it at that point in time. I never, ever considered doing anything else ever since. So I had a little bit of an opportunity to learn a lot about just basic fundamental drawing skills and things like that when I was in high school, which gave me a little bit of an advantage from that standpoint. I left high school, wasn't in a position to go to college, so I got a job. I was able to, after a lot of street pounding, I landed a drafting job with a company that did modular buildings. And so I drew modular buildings for several years, me and one other guy, the head of the engineering department, and me, I was the engineering department. And I learned a lot of stuff. I spent summers and over the years framing houses or concrete and things like that. So I really just really enjoyed learning how buildings went together. I learned the fundamentals of planning. I learned the fundamentals of codes and detailing and things. And I just thought it was fascinating. I just devoured everything I could get. I ate, slept, and breathed it all day long. And when I finished my day job, I drew remodel house plans for contractors in the evening. So it was a lot of fun. As I got through a couple of years of that, a buddy of mine from high school had been attending Cal Poly at Pomona, suggested maybe I should try that. So I enrolled and I gave it a try for maybe a little over a year. I didn't come from a family with means, raised by a single mom, didn't have the ability to pay for college. 4-State College was cheaper back then, but it was still too much to try to work 40 hours a week and take a full load of school. And it just wasn't happening for me. And I learned better doing than I'd learn in a classroom anyway. So Sunday night before classes started one quarter, I called up the next morning and canceled all my classes and went out and just started hunting for jobs. And this is like last century in the 70s, the Jimmy Carter era, 18% interest. Wasn't a good economy. Wasn't a good time to be looking for a job. So, man, I just annoyed people until I finally was able to land a job someplace and got started. And I never went. And that's, wow. So fortunately, you know, there's a number of states that allow you to earn your credentials, earn your skills, develop your competencies through practice. You don't have to go to college. California is one of them.
Yeah.
So they said, you got to work 7.5 years, then you can sit for the exam. So I worked 7.5 years and I sat for the exams and passed them and got licensed, and that's all there was about it. So that's my lovely, unadorned pathway.
Well, and it goes beyond that, right? It goes beyond your initial story to, I mean, your name was on the door of a firm, and now you're president at NCARB, and that firm was acquired by DLR Group. So there's been a lot of other stuff in there too. I love how it started though. I love how all this started with, you had a great high school drafting teacher. I had a great high school drafting teacher, Altaloma High School in the Inland Empire, not too far away from Riverside, where you were.
Lovely community.
Yeah. And sometimes. And I mean, it's just funny how many parallels, and I know with Cormac's story as well, very similar outcome and story along the way.
I can tell you, I knew that I needed to learn a lot about the profession to be successful. So I kind of invented my own sort of strategy. And one strategy that I figured out fairly early on is that every office is different. So I intentionally worked for a mid-sized firm for a number of years. And then I intentionally left and went to work for a very small mom and pop firm. Mm. And I worked there for a number of years, and I intentionally left and went to I worked for large firms. I worked for small firms. I worked for single owner firms. I even spent a torturous several years working for a firm that was a design oriented firm that their big name was winning design awards. And probably the most show office I ever saw in my life. I think I was the only guy in the entire place who knew how to detail a building, but it was interesting and I learned a lot of stuff. Mm. I learned a lot about the business aspect of things by asking lots of questions. When you're in school, your instructors aren't mentors. When you work in an office, you find your mentors sitting next to you and your supervisors, whoever it happens to be. And I was the beneficiary of people who are willing to tolerate my endless questions. And I learned a lot of stuff along the way. So I've actually run two firms. One was much larger, grew that with a lot of partners over the years, left there and started Baker Nowicki in 2011. And we created a pretty successful company and decided at one point it was a good time to see if we could sell it. We put a strategy together and sold our firm to DLR. And so now I'm a DLR guy.
Nice.
Excellent.
Cormac, you got anything there that you want to ask?
I love stories like that because as somebody who also came from a single parent, single father raising four kids who absolutely couldn't afford to go to college, I went the Army route and ultimately ended up in architecture. Very similar story. I had a high school teacher who he was our power mechanics teacher, our drafting teacher, and everything else. And so I learned how to rebuild cars from this guy, learned how to draft from this guy. I was his first TA because he didn't know what a TA was, but he was just like, this guy seems to be really apt at drawing and is picking things up. So he's going to help everybody else out. And the very first computer that I'd ever touched was his little Macintosh that had some very, very rudimentary drafting. Everybody else was doing hand drafting, and I got to mess around with this computer. And not that it stuck, but it was kind of amazing to be able to like be at this interesting threshold of, you know, hand drafting to computer drafting and stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I appreciate stories like that because a lot of times people don't think that, especially from coming from people who don't have the means to go to college, they don't really understand that architecture is for them. And one of the things, especially getting involved with ACE and all these other things that I do, I try to tell them that you can do this. If you have a passion for this, you can do this. And highlighting stories like yours is definitely one that I'm going to come back and I'm going to show all of my students that I work with at ACE. It's just like, watch this episode, because this episode is going to show you that you may think that you kiss, because I've heard it so many times. It's just like, well, you know, I really can't do this. I don't come from that kind of a family or something. Yeah. What do you mean you don't come from that kind of family?
Mm.
So I appreciate that opening story, because that just, I mean, I could go ahead and just, you know, log off now and be happy with the recording because
short episode.
I mean, I heard exactly because I love it.
Well, the interesting thing about this story, again, like this is just the beginning of it. And you said now you're a DLR guy, but now you're also an NCARB guy. And I'm wondering, we're going to be talking about some of the intentions that you have at NCARB and what you want to do there. And it seems kind of obvious to me now where those are coming from as well, as far as like how you got to where you are. But maybe you can now transition us into that part of your trajectory and your career.
Sure. I can kind of give you the backstory how I ended up where I am with NCARB. One of my learning moments was I'm sort of a chronic volunteer. So I've been involved in the Building Industry Association, the American Institute of Architects, Junior Achievement. I've sat on foundations. I've sat on design review committees. Honestly, if an opportunity comes up, somebody tells me about it, my first answer is, sure, I'll try it. I figure if I don't like it, I can always quit. But I've had a chance to really get exposed to and learn a lot of things that are not necessarily the mainstream of architecture, but they have a lot to do with people. They have a lot to do with business. They have a lot to do with the way things just work in society and in municipalities and things. And I've gotten a chance to learn a lot through that process. So at one point, someone suggested that I should volunteer for a state board in California. Well, okay, so what kind of state boards are there? And they sent me a list. And I go down through the list and I picked one. I thought, that sounds interesting. It's something to do with codes. So I told her that, how about if I volunteer for that? She says, oh, no, I think you should be on the architects. And I said, what do they do? I have no idea what they, I've been licensed for, at this point, like, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. I don't know. And I've had an NCARB certificate since 1987, for crying out loud. You'd think I'd know something about it. And so I took the advice. I applied. I got appointed. And so I spent 13 years on the California board. I had had no idea what the regulation side of the practice was all. I went to, I went to my first meeting and they never even talked about architecture. I walked away thinking, what the heck are these people talking about? And what does this have to do with what I do? But over the years, I've gained a real appreciation for what the regulatory process means from the standpoint of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public, how you create these opportunities to regulate who gets licensed, how they practice, what do you do when they don't practice well, when they take advantage of clients, things of that nature, and the discipline side of things. It's been really a fascinating thing. So I got on, I was actually, I have a distinct thing. I'm kind of proud of this. I was originally appointed to the California board by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay. And then I got reappointed by Jerry Brown. So I figure I straddled the political stream like nobody's business.
Both sides of the coin there. Right.
So I have certificates signed by both of them. Anyway, when I joined the California board, California had a less than satisfactory relationship with NCARB. As a matter of fact, the California board at that time referred to NCARB as the evil empire. We all hate them. They're all evil. They don't like us. We're never going to do anything they tell us to do. We had created our own programs and refused to accept NCARB's programs. At one point, California even wrote its own exam because they refused to use the national exam. I mean, all of this stuff was going on. So when I got on there, all I heard was just how awful this organization was. So I heard NCARB was having a regional meeting in Tucson. So on my own nickel, I just jumped on a plane, flew over there, and I attended the meeting. I'm a board member, so I thought, I'll see what this is all about. It turns out they're not that bad. They're just, it was a relationship of extensive misunderstandings and rivalries that were totally unnecessary. So over one of the things I thought would be helpful, I'll take on the duty of seeing if I can help make a better relationship between our organizations. And turns out while working with them, they decided they would work with us. There's been some cultural changes in the way NCARB operates with when Mike Armstrong joined the organization back, I don't know, 15 years ago or more. And so over time, we've developed a really great relationship and we work very closely with them. So having attended a few NCARB meetings during my lengthy term on the California board, I ended up deciding to join the NCARB board and kind of move up the ranks to see if there's some things I could do that would help the process even more. And that's kind of how I ended up doing that. It's just more volunteerism, I guess. But I finally turned off. I turned out of the California board a few years ago, so I'm no longer on that board. But you're only allowed to serve 2 4-year terms, and I was on the board for 13 years. So I've tried to figure out the math, but without a college diploma, that's a lot of math to figure out. I finished somebody's term that didn't count, and then I slid through the grace period on the other end. So I almost served 3 terms.
Fuzzy math, yeah.
I was going to say, you've given the reason why most people that I meet, they're like, oh, yeah, I wanted to go into architecture, but I couldn't do the math.
Yeah, right.
I know that there's also contentious relationships between state AIAs and national AIA as well. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has to do with this kind of secondhand stories and influential people and influential positions. And, people just follow and they tend to believe what they hear. And I'm curious, from your standpoint, it sounds like you're very self-motivated and you're not just going to take somebody at their word. You're going to go find out for yourself. Is that really describe you as a person and like the steps that you went through to start to figure this stuff out? Because that kind of toxicity, I mean, that's all over our profession, right? We can't deny that that's in firms, that's in large organizations. But I think the symptoms are kind of the same, right? It's like the stories get blown out of proportion based on some bad interactions, and then there's influence and there's followers, and there's very little like actual fact checking to go see what's actually going on, or proactive repairing trying to happen as well. So I'm just curious from your point of view, like how that all fits into this, and why is this such a big problem in architecture? I mean, it's definitely not just architecture, but we see it all over architecture.
I don't think architecture invented this problem. I think it's rampant in a lot of places. Well, I'll say this. Unlike a lot of architects, I started out as a little bit of an introvert. I'd be happy sitting at my drafting board and just drawing all day long and not talking to anybody. When you get into the business and you start developing your skills and you see what you want to do, especially when you get into firm leadership, firm ownership, all that stuff, client relationships, I refer to myself as the reluctant extrovert. So you sort of develop a new skill set, and along the way, I discovered I actually like people. And you know, the funny thing about it is if you don't know somebody and you start talking to them, I can guarantee you within 5 minutes of conversation, you're going to find something you have in common. Look at the three of us already. And I honestly believe you could walk down the street and pick any stranger at random, talk to them for 5 minutes, you're going to find something that you have in common with them. I don't know what that's called, but I just think it's true. And the reality is most people are just trying to do the best they can and be responsible. And if you just take, I just take that approach, and I've discovered that if I don't understand somebody, or even if they've said something that I thought was maybe a bit of a problem, I'll just go right to them and have a conversation. And I'll discover that either I misunderstood it or they didn't mean to say it the way they said it. And you make friends that way. And so I think a lot of the relationships that happen between state boards and our state board, California and NCAR, was maybe just personality related. Maybe there's a little ego mixed into it. I can't
in
really
architecture. No,
I've heard rumors. I don't know that I could tell you what I think is going on between AIA and their local chapters. I mean, I spent 8 years on the San Diego AIA, did my stint as president, and I spent a couple of years on the California Council as a director. And, you know, most people I worked with just were just trying to do good work, and they worked hard at it. So.
Yeah. Well, you are now the president at NCARB, correct? And how long have you been president? And give us kind of an understanding of what NCARB is currently trying to do.
Okay. It's a short answer, a short question with a pretty long answer. So,
sorry.
The board terms are coterminous with NCARB's fiscal year, which is July 1st through end of June. So at the end of June, my term as president will be over, and our annual meeting, and I'll turn the baton over to Ken Van Tye from Detroit. One of the things that NCARB does really well with their board is to really focus on sort of continuity of leadership. So we're a pretty tightly knit group, and even though we cycle new board members in all the time, and our regions elect representatives from their regions each year, and we'll have two or three new board members every year, we focus a lot on the continuity of that leadership. So we work on make sure everybody's up to speed on issues and that we're supporting the issues, because the things that we deal with are multi-year issues.
Sure.
There's nothing that happens in a 12-month window that makes any difference to anybody ever. And so I'm still working on initiatives that began three presidents ago, because they set them in place, and they've gone through the cycle of being introduced, the research that's been done, the strategies that come out of that, and then the policies that have to get changed on a national level and adopted by all the member boards. So it's a lengthy process. And so that continuity is very important. So I've been involved in a lot of issues that have been going on for the last 4 years on the board, and those that are coming behind me are going to be, you know, picking up the baton from me and carrying a lot of the initiatives forward that we're starting this year. So that's kind of the first part of the process. But my term ends in June, and then I'll have a year as past president where I'll participate with the board at that level, and then my tour of duty is over. I'm free to move about the country, I guess, after that on my own terms. the things that NCARB works on, so that your viewers understand, NCARB doesn't license anybody. NCARB is a really, really a facilitator among all of the 55 jurisdictions that do license architects to practice in their jurisdiction. That's the 50 states and the other five U.S. territories, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, all of those. Because of the need for a practice and the idea of reciprocity, NCARB really began from the standpoint of trying to unify the policies with all of the region, all of the individual jurisdictions, so that the NCARB certificate could then be used for reciprocity for architects that move from one state to another, or they have a national practice. If you're a lawyer and you leave California and go to Iowa, you got to take the bar over again. That's not the case with, because we use a national exam that NCARB created. Everybody adopted the experience program, which used to be IDP and now is AXP, all of those things. And there's a lot of model law that NCARB creates to help facilitate that sort of that national perspective on how we practice and where we practice. But at the end of the day, NCARB doesn't issue a license to anybody. They issue a certificate for those that are licensed and meet certain qualifications, but jurisdictions do. So everything that we do, even if we think it's a great idea and we work all the bugs out, we still have to convince 55 jurisdictions to adopt it. Mm. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. Right. And if you go across the board with a lot of our policies, a lot of them are adopted by a lot of states. There are some policies that are adopted by some and not others. It's a little bit of a hit and miss depending on which policy it happens to be. So we do a lot of facilitation with the board. So like all the other strategies that we put in place, things we're working on this year that I consider important, once we are done developing strategy for how to implement them, we have to work with all of our 55 jurisdictions to make sure they're comfortable with it, that their legislatures are okay with it, and that they will adopt those same policies. Otherwise, nice. They don't mean anything.
Right. And one of your current campaigns now is, I think, again, kind of illustrated by your path to licensure, but it is multiple paths to licensure, correct?
Yeah.
And yes. And you guys published, NCARB published, an op-ed, which I think was authored by you in the Architects newspaper last November, kind of talking about that. And I know you got a lot of feedback on that too. So maybe you can lay out what your op-ed put out there, and then we can get into the feedback side of things.
Sure. Here's the thing. Some of the thought behind this started a number of years ago when we all began to focus on diversity, inclusion, equity, and the leadership of our organization. We're not the only organization that dealt with it. A lot of organizations did. But in our organization, if you look at the composition of the NCARB board, for instance, it's not representative of our member boards across the board from a racial and ethnic and cultural diversity standpoint. But then again, our member boards aren't necessarily very indicative of our profession from a diversity standpoint. And our profession is not very indicative of our communities. Mm-hmm. So when we say we want our board to be right. representative of our communities, there's a lot of other hurdles we have to get over to deal with that. So when I think about the multiple pathway issue, I think also about two sort of categories of people. There are those who just don't have the means to be able to go to a university and pay tuition. They may have an interest, they may have a talent, but if the only pathway to get licensed as an architect is through a 5-year accredited degree and hundreds of thousand dollars worth of tuition, they're never going to get there. They just aren't.
Right.
I also think about a lot of underrepresented groups that maybe fall into that same category who aren't going to have an opportunity because of financial reasons, because of cultural barriers, because of family obligations. They're young, they have a young family, they're never going to have the time or the money to be able to go to a university, that sort of thing. And they're kept down. I didn't invent multiple pathways. They already exist.
Yeah.
30% of our jurisdictions, 18 of them, are already, like California and New York and Arizona and Washington State, allow licensure without a college and accredited degree. Mm-hmm. They have pathways that allow that. They will recognize partial education at a 2-year community college or a 4-year unaccredited program. as a part of, in California's case, it's 7.5 years. It could be 100% education or 100% experience or any division between that in order to qualify. And so the idea is to develop that idea more broadly in a way that all of our jurisdictions can adopt it, because it addresses two problems. It addresses the lack of diversity and inclusion and equity within our profession and mm-hmm. within our leadership. But it also provides opportunity for those people who are never going to be able to go through a university and incur the debt or have the time to be able to do it. So trying to address those things through this process.
What has been some of the feedback on, I don't know if we want to call it apprenticeship pathway, or essentially that's what I kind of consider it. I have a really good friend who, in the state of Maryland, he got licensed after 10 years of practice under a licensed architect, and he was able to sit for the licensure exam and then ultimately get licensed. And what was interesting about that was the stigma that comes with that in certain cases of, well, you know, you didn't really work for it the same way I did and things like that. And I'm just kind of curious, like, have you been getting feedback like that when you put that as a path of licensure? Do you get feedback like that? Do you see the animosity that, because I mean, honestly, I'm just going to put it out there. I'm for it, because this guy that I'm talking about, amazing architect. I don't care if he didn't go to school. He started to go to school. He exactly what you said. He had a family and couldn't afford to continue on with his degree. And so he just continued to work, and he worked hard, and he learned everything that he could about the profession, probably more so than a lot of people who are in it, because he's working side by side with people who have gone through all the different pitfalls of architecture and became an architect that in a lot of cases would be enviable to other architects because of what he has been able to learn. But there is still this stigma that is like, oh, but you didn't go to school. It's like, so how good are you? Like, really?
Well, you know, I've got some interesting feedback. I think to some extent, there's a certain fear of change. There's processes that people have adopted and they live by it and they don't want to see it threatened. And so they feel threatened. And so they'll say things that maybe are not complimentary. I tend to chalk that up a little bit more to a little bit more of a protectionist approach to some things. So I've had if you saw my op-ed, then you probably saw the response that was published by, there's a professor and there's ACIA and then NAB, all issued responses. And it was interesting, the things they said. Some of them were a little bit offensive, but, you know, I mean, I don't know, I've been called bad words by nicer people than them. But things like, okay, well, this is going to create a two-class sort of system. There'll be the really good architects who go to school, and then there'll be the also-rans who couldn't go to school, so they're going to be marginal performers. That's the inference, which is, in my experience, completely false and is not based on any factual information whatsoever, because, you know, we don't license, the competencies to become a licensed architect have nothing to do with being good. They have to do with being competent. Mm-hmm. And there's good and marginal performers in every profession, and they come from every place. So,
there's
comments about that. There's comments that NCARB doesn't support accredited education and we want to undermine the colleges. Well, the fact of the matter is 85% of licensed architects come through accredited programs. NCARB not only supports it, but we create and work with all the licensing advisors at all the universities. We work with the American Institute of Architecture students. We sponsor the Learning by Design program that they do at school. We also spend over $400,000 a year helping to finance the accreditation process through NAB, along with ACSA and the AIA. So, to suggest that we suddenly don't support accredited education is just laughable. I think the professor who wrote that part of that op-ed response made the inference that I somehow had an advantage because I'm a white male. So the fact that I didn't go to college. It was easier for me to get a job and easier for me to get ahead. There was nothing easy about my path. And to suggest there was is a pretty arrogant statement. I had to work really hard. I was still young. And when in this profession, when you're young, in any profession, when you're young and trying to get in, you don't have any credibility. Nobody knows what you can do. You haven't developed any kind of credentials or anything to go along with it. So it's difficult for everybody, and it doesn't matter where you come from. So, there are those things. But I can tell you, every time I talk about this subject to other organizations like the AIA or NOMA or AIAS, I just get applause. And even the students who are going through accredited programs support this agenda, because I think they see the value of it. It doesn't threaten them. It doesn't threaten the program, and doesn't threaten accredited education in any way. It just provides another pathway that should just be considered an equal pathway to everything else, so that anybody who wants to have a pathway into this profession can find a way to get there. And right now, that's not universally available to them.
Yeah, I think, not only does the diversity enrich the profession, but, if you think about it, it is still all architect educated, right? I mean, whether you're architecture educated through the universities, so you're being educated by architects, or you're being educated by architects through the profession, it is still the profession that is kind of dictating what is as you said, the level of competency needed to become an architect.
Yeah, yeah. But a couple of other things that we're actually doing, and a few of these initiatives started a few years ago, and we are in the midst of them now, really has to do with that whole issue of competency. And so we actually have two task forces, one that was started a couple of years ago and one that I started this year, that look at competency. The task force on competent practice has just finished their first phase of work to identify 60 key competencies for initial licensure based on professions input, based on input from licensing boards, from students. What are the competencies that you really should have at the point of licensure? And then the second one, which we started this year, we call it our workforce readiness work group. And they're looking at the competencies for entry-level employment. To look at what are the things that a student coming out of, say, a community college program or a four-year program, if that's as far as they're going to go with their education, what do they do next? If they can't, if they have the credits to be able to articulate to a university program, that's fine. That's one way. But if they don't, and they better go get a job, do they have the competencies for the entry-level employment? So we're building that competency model now. And what I think we believe at NCARB is going to happen is those two competency models are going to start to inform what happens with the experience program in the future. It's going to inform what happens with the examination process in the future. How do you test for these competencies and things of that nature? And at some point, hopefully, it'll start to inform maybe what happens in the educational systems, whether it's an accredited program or a non-accredited program or a two-year program or otherwise, to say, here's some of the things that we haven't been focusing, but if we focus on them, they'll develop the competencies that are necessary for licensure and employment.
You mentioned community college, and so it sounds like that is a potential additional pathway to licensure. Could you kind of name out what some of these additional pathways to licensure are, and how you what the vision is for those two? Like, what would be the things that people would go through to get various pathways, because you've mentioned 18 states have the model that you basically took yourself, right? And so that's one additional pathway to licensure. But what are some of the other ones?
Well, there's somewhere in the order of 180 some community college architectural programs across the country. And if you ever get a chance to go visit those programs, talk to those students, look at their projects, see what they're actually learning in their two-year experience of education in that program, And you're going to find some really interesting things about the technical knowledge that they're coming away with.
I've taught in one of those.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm an advisor for one right now. And I agree with you. Like, and they try really hard to provide an architectural education to students at that level.
Yeah.
I think there's a pretty good balance between design and the technical aspects of building technology, all that there. So there are students who come out of a two-year program, and across the country, the articulation agreements for those students to be able to get credit when they transfer to an accredited program are a little bit hit and miss. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get full credit. Very often they don't. Mm-hmm. And the university kind of drives that. And so helping those students make sure that maybe we start helping to develop a national model for articulation agreements that would help support those programs. So when they get, when they complete 2 years of architectural program at a community college, they get 2 years of credit. They can move into a third year at a school. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful to them. If they don't, and they have developed enough competency for entry-level employment, then they should be able to leave that two-year program and go out and get a job. And maybe their pathway converts from that point on to an experience pathway. And that would be the goal at that point. We have a lot of four-year non-accredited architectural mm-hmm. programs all over the place. Mm-hmm. NCARB has tried to suggest to the NAB and the ACSA that we should have an accreditation model for four-year universities. And we've been told for years and years and years that it's just not possible. You can't mm-hmm. learn all this stuff in 4 years. It's 160 hours or whatever it is that's required, and you can't do that. And you can't learn architecture in less than those 160 credit hours. Well, the reality is the current president of NAB, Steve Schreiber, who's a good friend, and I can't say enough good things about him. He spent years on, he's on the NAB board president, he's been on the ACSA board, he's been on the NCARB. And when we were on the NCARB board together, he told us that he's a professor at University of Massachusetts. He said, it's totally possible to create an accredited program for a four-year college. And so based on his knowledge, because he knows a lot more about it than I do, we continue to push that issue in hopes that for those students who go to a four-year university and can do it in 4 years, they have a shot at having an accredited degree just like 5 years. So we've actually issued a paper recommending that to the NAB that they work on creating that. So there's 2 year programs, there's 4 year programs. We don't know what the ultimate policy would look like, but when we launched this initiative, Pathways to Practice, a year ago, we had a number of states almost immediately say, oh, we've been thinking about the same thing and we want to do something now. We're not even going to wait. So we asked them if they could just pump the brakes a little bit. And so we've actually come up with a recommendation so that while we go through this process of developing a strategy, working with all the member boards so that they're comfortable with the strategy so that they could ultimately adopt it, while we go through that multi-year process, we've suggested a sort of a guideline that says if you really want to do something sooner, maybe you could do something along these lines that balances various combinations of education and experience, like we do in California and other states, that say that if you're not going to have a 5-year accredited degree and 3 years of experience before you get licensed, could you swap and do 6 years of experience and 2 years of education, or 4 years of education and 4 years of experience, some combination of those, and provide some variability in that so that candidates would have that option depending on what pathway they take. Mm-hmm. In the end, that may be along the lines of what we think we might end up with, because it's a model that already works and has worked for decades and decades in many states already. And so we tried to create a sort of just a guideline and issued it to those states that if you try to follow something along these lines, you won't be too far outside the swim lane when we get to a solution down the road. And so we don't end up with 55 different approaches to this whole thing. So that's been kind of the initial strategy on this.
Well, it's kind of exciting to hear, because I've had experiences with interns who are typically would go through the 4+2 path not in a traditional, like, say, BARC path, like it, I think all three of us have, or I'm sorry, two of us have. You went to Pomona, would have done the same thing, but I went to Auburn. I know Evan went to Pomona as well, and it was a five-year path. And so once we were completed with it, we were done, and that was fine. But I've lost many an intern who they come in, they work for us after their 4 years are up and don't necessarily get immediately selected into the master's program or put on a waiting list or things like that. And, you know, basically start to either, I won't say fall out of love, but fall out of money, fall out of means to be able to continue on. And so we lose them in the profession because they either take the draftsman kind of role or they just say, well, I can't continue on. I'm going to go see what else I can do with my 4-year degree somewhere else. And to show them that, hey, I'm you know, fingers crossed on this moving forward. But I mean, being able to show them a pathway to say, okay, you've got your 4 years. There's a different path for you to do this so that you don't, if you don't get into that master's program, you still can become an architect. And we don't lose them because I've lost so many really, really talented, really passionate people for the profession that just can't afford to continue on. And I mean, those are the people that we want. We want the passion. We want the dedication. We want the people who, you know, really understand what they're getting into and still want to do this. it was a weird way to put it, but you know what I'm getting at.
Well, I want to throw in there too that you don't have to get licensed to continue on in this profession, and everybody knows that. And one thing that we established pretty well in our last episode was that there are benefits to getting licensed early for the individual and their career, but also the firm that they're working for. And there's various reasons for that. But Cormac and I are both examples of people who did not get licensed until later in our midlife. And there's potential in the industry that you have when you're licensed that you don't have when you're not licensed. But the truth of the matter is, and I think we're seeing this a lot in the younger generations, a little contrary to something that I heard in our last episode from our guest, but that is that there's a lot of young people deliberately choosing not to get licensed, but they are still following the path of architecture, working in firms without that credential, without that liability, whatever you want to call it. Like, there's a lot of things we could call that. But I mean, the truth of the matter is you don't have to get licensed to continue. And so if you're losing people, I don't know that that's necessarily the reason.
Well, but you know as well as I do, and I'll use myself as an example, that, you know, not having a license was a roadblock for promotions, roadblock for other things. Plus, and I told this story to Evan and on our last one, we were sitting around a table at one of the AIA conventions and somebody had blurted out, I don't know why I was a topic of conversation on the other end of a dining table, but somebody was just like, Cormac, you're not licensed? And it was like this wave of shame just rolled over me of like, you know, what the hell do you mean? You know, it's just like,
but there are like, plenty of people who are completely not shamed by that too. I'll just point that out. Like so shame washed over you, but not everybody.
But the profession does have that kind of stigma of if you are going to be in architecture and you have the pathway to licensure to call yourself an architect, why haven't you done it? You know. Why, you know, just do it, you know?
Well, my question for NCARB, for you, John, is like, what are the benefits to licensure? Let's put them out there right now from your point of view, but also from NCARB's point of view.
My point of view, getting a license gives you options. Without a license, your options are working for somebody. But if you want to get into leadership, if you want to make an impact and really apply what you think should be important in how firms are run and how employees are treated and opportunity, all those things that change the culture of our profession, everything else, then you got to get licensed. Otherwise, you don't really have options other than working for somebody. And there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing shameful about it. We've all worked in firms. I can guarantee you everybody who's ever worked in a firm can point to the couple of people in that firm who didn't have licenses. They've been at this for 20 or 30 years, and that's who you go to when you have a question, because nobody knows this stuff better than them. Yeah. It doesn't matter if they have a license or not. But if young people getting into the profession have the ability to get licensed, they should get licensed, because though once you have that, your future has a lot of opportunity and options available to you that you don't have otherwise. I've had the privilege of being able to own a firm and build a firm culture that I thought was important to do good architecture and make clients happy and do all the things that I thought should be done to run a successful practice. And turns out it was, and it worked out really well for us. But you don't get a chance to drive if you don't have a license.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just tell people the first thing you do, just get licensed and then figure it out after that. Just do it.
The average time right now, what is the average length of time that it's taking people to get licensed from graduation? Isn't it something like 13 and a half years or something?
I don't know. You know, my short-term memory is not so good. And I think it's somewhere around those numbers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Technically, like California, I think New York's 10 years. California's 7.5, 8 years. You know, if you applied yourself, that's the shortest amount of time you can get there from the time you start. But, you know, I'm not sure that everybody applies themselves as diligently as they could. So they spend 5 years in school, and maybe that 5 years actually took them six because they took some time off or couldn't get a class or ran out of money and worked a few summers. I don't know. And then do they get licensed after 3 years of experience, or does it take them five, or does it take them six? Or do they put it off and they don't get to it? In the old days, they gave the exam once a year. I mean, everybody studied for that, because if you missed it, you waited a whole year. Now you can take it anytime you want. So I think it's easy to say, well, I'll do it next month instead of this one. So why it takes 13 years, I don't know. It's individual choices, but I think that's the number I've heard.
Well, the reason I ask is because I'm wondering if NCARB is trying to address that time span, because I think when people hear those numbers, like, it's kind of a scary number to hear too. It's like, oh my God, this is going to take forever. It's going to take a lot of money and commitment, and you've got life. You've got all the other things. You do have your career. You maybe have other responsibilities outside of your career. How do you start squeezing all that in? We all know the longer you wait to do it, the harder it actually is to get back into it because of all those other responsibilities, right? So I'm wondering, from NCARB's position, is there anything being done to address that length of time getting that smaller? Again, going back to the idea that there are benefits to individuals and firms for people to get licensed earlier in their careers than later.
Actually, there's a number of things that we've done. We can't change human behavior.
Right.
We can't
modify.
You
could incentivize it potentially, but
you know, it can't motivate people to do things they're not going to get around to doing. But you know, probably about 7-8 years ago, we created the IPAL program, short for Integrated Path to Architectural Licensure. And for universities that are interested, we approved them to integrate both the internships and the examination within the period of time while students are in school. So that it's not done sequentially, so it's all done concurrently, and they can take exams when it's relevant to what they're learning in school. They can get internships to work part-time and then work through summers and get also, but the idea was, by the time they got out of school, they literally could have all their experience hours completed, and technically they could have passed the exams. I had a young guy working for me for a few years here, just a couple years ago. He 6 months before he graduated from his 5-year program here in San Diego, he had already passed all the exams and he had already completed all of his internship hours. He was a little annoyed that he had to wait the 6 months to finish school to actually get his license, but he did it. And it took a lot of discipline. It took a lot of hard work, but he shortened the time frame. So there's that. Promoting a 4-year accredited program is designed to address two things. One is the additional year of tuition costs, and also the additional year of time it takes to get out of school for those students who take that pathway. The idea of being able to mix and match experience with education should shorten that time frame, because statutorily, every state has a duration in place now that says once you've completed this number of years, you can take the exam and you can hold a license. And so I think working with that just provides opportunities for those students who might look at it and say, otherwise, you know, the stats say it's going to take me 15 years. I could be a brain surgeon in 15 years for crying out loud. Why would I do that? Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible to do it faster. I think all we can do is just remove the barriers that are there, that are in the way. And then it becomes an individual choice on just discipline and work and focus to get it done.
So I asked you earlier about the backlash or comments or impressions about the kind of apprentice, the 10-year, the 7.5-year pathway to licensure. And I know when it was announced for the IPAL or licensure upon graduation type solution that the profession was in an uproar. It's just how can somebody with no experience be ready to have a license and all of that other stuff? And how has NCARB kind of dealt with that conversation? Because, I mean, looking at the path that I took of taking forever to get my license.
17 and looking years at, here. Yeah.
And yeah. Here.
Right.
And
you're not helping the average guys.
Nope.
Exactly. But looking back to it, so we both had different like reasons and rationales why. I mean, mine was this weird little, you know, belief in the back of my head that I, coming from the military, it's just like you needed to have the skills of the job that you want before you get that job. And so I had this weird little thing in my head. It's just like, you know, you got to be at least, you know, 10 years of experience before you can call yourself an architect, which erroneously was just nonsense. And so, I mean, I have my own opinions about the early licensure. And they're at first, I probably was getting ready to sharpen my pitchfork. But then as I started to see more and more of the people who have been doing this and the dedication that they have to learning, to the dedication that they have to gaining that experience as quickly as they can, these are people who are driven to become the future leaders of the profession. And my opinion has greatly changed since that has. But I'm curious about like what is NCARB, you know, how has NCARB kind of dealt with maybe the backlash or the upheaval of from the profession about kind of like these early licensure pathways?
I think it stems from sort of this, speaking as a practitioner, sort of this universal dissatisfaction that most practitioners have that the education system is not really preparing people for practice the way we think it should. And the response from the education community has said, well, we're not a trade school. Our job is not to train students to become practicing architects. We're training creative thinkers and design thinkers. You, the Mr. Profession, you're going to have to teach them all that other stuff, which is a little bit of an abdication of responsibility, in my opinion. But at the same time, we did a study, Baseline for Belonging, with Noam. 40% of respondents said their college education did not prepare them for practice. And it gets even worse when you talk to graduates from four-year programs who were more likely to say their education prepared them for practice more so than students coming out of five-year programs. And if you talk to African American women, very few, like maybe 30% of them felt their education prepared them for the profession. So there's sort of this universal belief that, you know, the education system doesn't prepare students very well for practice. So when they show up at my doorstep, and I've been an employer for many decades, a recent graduate is unlikely, without having had some serious experience in an office for a few years, going to understand what's going to be expected of them in an office and what they're actually going to do. And it's not going to be like they did in school. And so there's some concern about that. We don't have much influence over what happens in the academy and how they teach. We haven't had much influence over the accreditation criteria that the NAB imposes. We're trying to work with those organizations to try to achieve a better balance between design and the practical application of how buildings go together and how systems work and how you manage design teams and all that stuff that a client expects you to know when you take on a project with them. But there's still a lot of dissatisfaction and concern about that. And so I I think a lot of it stems from that this idea that you could go to 5 years of university and be licensed by graduation, when most practitioners look at it and say, well, most kids coming out of a five-year program don't really know how to practice. So how can you give them a license? So integrating internships with the education process, requiring internships, requiring a certain amount of experience. I don't know at what point education suddenly became more important than actual experience. I always grew up with this understanding that experience trumps everything. If you've never had any experience, how do you know anything? And so the integration of those two things is really important. And our competency models, I think, are going to start to help provide at least a defensible basis for saying, these are good things that students are learning, but they also need to learn these things as well, because the industry and the licensing jurisdictions all believe that to be in competent practice, you've got to know these other things as well. So hopefully some of that could shift. But if not, creating pathways where students can pick the path that works for them is the other alternative.
Well, John, I feel like this has been, we've probably covered enough ground, at least, let's just at least call this a part one. Maybe there'll be a part two or a part three in the future, because, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of moving parts, to your point, right? There's NAB, ACSA, there's the AIA, there's NCARB, and there's all of these firms, and there's all of these schools, and everybody's kind of pointing fingers in different directions, and there's some people who are taking various responsibility in it. And the practice is evolving faster than ever right now, than at least in my experience, than I've seen before. And things are changing. And so there's definitely going to be more topics to talk about in the near future. But I appreciate you taking the time to kind of lay out this multiple pathways to licensure campaign that NCARB is doing and why it's important. And I think your points about the JEDI part of it, the equity, the inclusion, the underserved people, the people without means to go to universities and spend the money to do so and go through 4, 5, 6, 7 year programs to get there, and then still have to do all the internships and then still pass all the exams. Like I said, there's a lot of moving parts here. So thanks for helping kind of lay all that out. And I appreciate you taking the time to do that. And it's been a good conversation. I've definitely learned a lot today.
Absolutely. It's totally my pleasure, and I'm happy to talk anytime you'd like.
Perfect.
We're going to take him up on that offer.
All right. Until next time then. All right. Thank you very much. Great.